LTD, Lincoln Town car. Some of that El Dorado funk. I'm talking about gangsta shit. No, lay back. Cool out. Yeah. No, we keep it crunk around here. A-time staff.
Evening, everyone. My name is Jude Seymour. I'm the writer and editor at One Foot Down. With me tonight is Brad Wechter, a fellow editor. Hello, Brad.
How's it going? We got the duet going tonight, two guys.
Just flying without the fearless leader tonight, Josh. So he's on assignment, and by on assignment, I mean at work. So we're just going to get started here with a couple of topics that we thought were worthy of discussion. First and foremost, we have two big commitments for Notre Dame later this week. The first is Chris Tyree. He's a four-star running back. He is going to announce his commitment at 3 o'clock tomorrow, which is Thursday. On CBS Sports HQ, which I believe is a streaming service that you can get maybe through the internet. He is down to Notre Dame, Oklahoma, and Alabama, and he's supposed to take an official visit to Notre Dame June 21st to 23rd, which I imagine he will not take if he commits to Oklahoma or Alabama tomorrow. Why is this important? Tyree runs a 4.38 40-yard dash. He is considered the number one overall running back in both Rivals and 24/7 Sports, and the number 51 overall in 24/7 Sports, and number 60 overall in Rivals. If you listen to the Irish Illustrated podcast, you've heard that that the belief is that Tyree will commit tomorrow to the Irish, and that the Irish will only take one running back in its entire 2020 class. So before we get to Braden McGregor, I just want to talk to Brad a little bit about Tyree, or more the idea of just taking one running back in a class. What do you feel? That makes me a little uneasy, Brad. How does that make you feel?
It does, yeah. I mean, if you're going to only take one, this would be the one. But I think a lot of times what we get a little uneasy about some of the offensive skill talent that we've seen and the turnover we've seen with Notre Dame, and potentially, you know, depth is always the issue when we're talking about Notre Dame going up against the elite programs like Clemson and Alabama or Oklahoma, who's in this kid's top three. It's just that's the concern is how many of these kids are going to turn out and actually contribute to the team. And if you're only taking one, what are you doing with your depth? And I think we saw that with some poor defensive recruiting during Brian Van Gorder's days and how that hurt the defensive depth just as recently as last year. So that's where the concern comes from, and I definitely get it.
Yeah, I just if for some reason Notre Dame is not a great fit for him when he comes and he's on campus and he's starting to struggle like maybe Noah Boykenfelt before he left, or Luke Jones and his homesickness. For some reason, if he was dissatisfied and were to leave, it would leave quite a hole in that class. I agree with your central premise, though, that if you're going to take one guy, it better be the number one all-purpose back. So I'm pretty excited about the possibility of him committing. It seems like a done deal, sort of one of those worst-kept secret sort of deals. But I guess we'll know for tomorrow at 3 o'clock or Thursday if you're listening to this at a different date. Braden McGregor is the other one. He's going to commit at 7 p.m. Friday. He's doing it in his high school auditorium. I don't believe there's any kind of live stream. He's a four-star defensive end, 24/7. Actually, 24/7 Sports and Rivals are pretty split on this guy. Rivals actually has him as a three-star, I believe. 24/7 Sports believes he's the number four strong side defensive end, number 27 overall. And Rivals has him as number 27, but in his position group, number 27 strong side defensive end. So so there isn't a consensus of opinion yet about Braden McGregor. He is considering between among Notre Dame, Michigan, and Florida. He had an official visit to Florida over the last week. And according to reporting by Carter Correls of ndinsider.com yesterday, he's had little to no contact with Notre Dame this week. That doesn't sound very good, does it, Brad?
Does not, no. Plus, you know, you're two Midwestern schools going up against Florida. I don't know.
Yeah, the Irish Illustrated guys say this is a coin flip between Notre Dame and Michigan. Some people like Notre Dame slightly more. I would say little to no contact with Notre Dame this week. Either he's playing some sort of weird, he's afraid to let the secret out, or I'm not sure what the deal is. Apparently, during his April official visit, he almost committed to Notre Dame, but then also apparently he also almost committed to two other schools during his official visit. So maybe he's a guy that just gets excited easily. Just as a reminder, Notre Dame already holds commitments from four other defensive linemen. Alexander Ehrensberger from Germany, Aiden from Hawaii, and Jordan Botello and Riley Mills. Botello and Mills just committed, I would say, probably within the last 2 or 3 weeks here. So that's your wrap-up about recruiting. Brad, anything else that I missed that you think we should add?
I think we're really getting the depth there at the end.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. I mean, and again, they should be looking at Notre Dame now and seeing all of our defensive ends and being either talked about as going in the NFL draft this year or next year and years beyond, and get excited and say, this is a place where I can really grow and foster and become an elite talent. So I hope McGregor picks Notre Dame. If he doesn't pick Notre Dame, I hope he does not pick Michigan, because, you know, I just don't want to listen to that crap. So that's the story there. Moving along, let's talk a little bit about schedule. Josh and I talked about this last time on the podcast. I'd love to get your thoughts. How often should we play Michigan?
You know, I keep flip-flopping on this one. It's, to me, it was always just the seminal rivalry. Like, this is the one team we hate. Just really hate. Like, you can say what you want about USC, but Michigan, there's something else there. There's been drama recently with the scheduling and the canceling and juggling this. But I mean, for me, it's a seminal early season matchup between two, you know, traditional Midwestern powerhouses with all kinds of bad blood. I would love to see it every year.
Really? Okay. Yeah. So I in the OFD poll that was posted by Josh last week, I picked two times a decade, and I like the idea of playing Michigan. I think it's a fun matchup, and Michigan is usually very good. It's, you know, Michigan fans like to talk a lot of guff online, and I think Notre Dame fans like to give it back to them. So there's some fun kind of war worlds, and then obviously the geographic proximity. I just, with our schedule being committed to five ACC teams, Stanford, USC, and Navy, there really isn't, in my view, an opportunity to add another team that's locked in. So I picked twice a decade because I'd actually like to see that spot rotate between Michigan, Michigan State, and Purdue. So I thought maybe
that's fair. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm an idealist.
If you could
play them all.
Fine. Great. Perfect. obviously I'd love to throw Ohio State in there too. I'm not looking to play them every year. That's, you know, the schedule is hard as it is. You know, sometimes when you get Clemson or Florida State's on the ascent, you know, obviously recently that hasn't been the case, but so that's how I feel about it. Too rich for my blood, but there was I think the number one option actually was play them every year. So there's definitely the fandom or at least the OFD readership that likes the idea of playing Michigan every year. Michigan is on our schedule this year for October 26th. It's probably one of the three games that's circled in pen or red pen as the kind of must-see games. Vegas has set the over-under for the schedule at 9.5 wins. Brad, I realize this is May 22nd, and we have not looked into the other teams and what they've lost and what they're bringing back. But as you just kind of eyeball the schedule, where do you shake out on the over-under of 9.5 wins?
I would go under, but just under. I'm thinking 9. 9 is a good year for me looking at the schedule. The tough games are, for the most part, on the road. I think it's really hard to win on the road. I think it's going to be really hard to win at Georgia and at Michigan and at Stanford. I think 9's what we're looking at.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's completely fair. Right now, I feel like I'm at 9 as well. I hate to admit that I kind of pencil in Michigan as a loss. Georgia's the one that seems like the clear loss to me.
Yeah.
I believe it was Dog Nation that had a post earlier this week that said basically this game wasn't going to be any close and Georgia was going to win something like 44-13.
I did see that, yeah.
I mean, Georgia brings back a lot of talent, so I'm not putting anything past Georgia. I don't think Notre Dame is a team that gets looked past, though. So I don't know about that. Michigan lost a lot. They lost a lot of talent, obviously. Chase Winovich and Rashawn Gary being at the top of that list, and then Devin Bush. But they've got a lot of people who are good and are going to continue to return this year. Levert Hill, Shea Patterson, Kalaki Hudson amongst the group. So that one's going to be tough. It's in Ann Arbor. It's going to be, who knows? I mean, could that be an 8 o'clock game? You know, quite possibly. There was some talk online about CBS Sports in some way exercising an option that will allow them to show the Notre Dame Georgia game at 8 p.m. Mm. I thought for a long time that was going to be a 3:30. So right now, that's just a rumor. That's not anything that's set in stone. So the number of 8 o'clock games piling up, even though there's only one night game on the home schedule, could be problematic as you get later in the year. And then Stanford obviously finished the year there. We have not been able to beat Stanford in Palo Alto for quite a while. I just, the ending the year there has been really tough, and hasn't Notre Dame hasn't fared very well there. So just looking to do a little bit better than they've done recently. It's been sort of a little bit of a house of horrors. 2017 was kind of the unraveling before the Citrus Bowl. 2015 was Kaiser scoring with about 35 seconds left, and then Brian Van Gorder's defense being unable to hold, and Stanford kicking a field goal to win. 2013 was Tommy Rees. I think we said enough there. So I can't. Maybe 2007 was the last time with the David Grimes and the catch that wasn't a catch. Maybe it'd be the last time that Notre Dame beat Stanford out in Palo Alto. So I think those are the three games. You're absolutely right. And then other games to watch. I think Virginia is going to be good this year. I think that might be one that might cause some trouble. Not as worried about Duke playing in Duke. I don't think that's going to be as much trouble. And I'm not worried about New Mexico State or Bowling Green or anything like that. I think Louisville is going to be psyched. They're going to be the crowd's going to be pretty raucous for that Labor Day Monday, possibly night game. New era, new coach, new kind of scheme. Brian Van Gorder and Bobby Petrino are gone, but I also don't think that they have enough talent to line up with Notre Dame. But you know, it's the first game of the year, so really anything can happen there. So, Brad, I think your analysis of those three games is exactly where I kind of land on that. So.
So do you feel like 9 wins and maybe say competitive in the losses is a good season for this team? Like as painful as it would be?
I mean, I think Notre Dame fans would be a little disappointed, right? Because after a playoff year and to not be able to beat assumedly the ranked teams on the road and continue to have that problem. So, you know, I've kind of gotten over the idea of a good loss. I'm a believer in 2015. I spent a lot of energy and time on the internet talking about how close that monsoon game was with Clemson and how Notre Dame should be considered for the playoff despite that loss. And I probably, you know, to a lesser extent talked about it in 2017 with Georgia and, oh, it's just a 1-point game. And, you know, there wasn't this play or that play, who knows, and stuff like that. But the playoff committee doesn't seem to value good losses. They don't seem to really put a lot of stake in that. So I think if you're serious about the playoffs, you've got to beat Georgia and Michigan. And if you have a loss, it's got to be a dumb loss early in the season. And then again, not to pick on Virginia, but you lose to Virginia. You go 11-1. I think that there's a playoff opportunity there, just depending on how everything else shakes out down the line. But I just without beating Georgia and Michigan, I don't think that there's really really an opportunity for the playoffs. So then you start looking at lesser goals, right? And one of the ones that I'd like to scratch off the list is to get into a major New Year's Six Bowl and win that. It's been since the Cotton Bowl in 1994 that Notre Dame's accomplished that. So if this is the year to go 9-3 and sneak into the, I'm just going to pick on one, Fiesta Bowl, and beat a team, I hope, you know, that's the consolation that, you know, you finish the season 10-3, but with a win in a major bowl.
Maybe for a change, don't draw the best team not in the playoff and maybe a team that should be in the
playoff. Yeah, I mean, just hate to play Ohio State in that slot, right? Because that seems what it always kind of shakes out. So one last topic when we're talking about schedule, other dream matchups. Josh and his little 30-minute solo podcast, I know, mentioned Tennessee as a team he'd like to see back on the schedule. Maybe you've been asked this before, but if you have, I've forgotten. Brad, is there a team that you'd like to see put on the Notre Dame schedule in the near future?
Just because these two schools have never played each other in football, I want to see Auburn on the schedule.
Oh my God, you just picked my – yes, Auburn is my pick too.
So we're in agreement then.
Yeah. A game at Jordan-Hare and a game at Notre Dame Stadium I think would be great.
That would be great.
Awesome. All right. The next topic I want to talk about is Josh had a post that Brian Kelly had gone on the Jim Rome show. The topic kind of got around to this obliquely got around to the second year curse of quarterbacks under Brian Kelly, at least at Notre Dame. And I just wanted to see if you felt like there was truth in this, or this was just a coincidence that quarterbacks in their second year seem to regress, at least statistically, under Brian Kelly.
I mean, when there's smoke, there's fire. I don't know that it's Brian Kelly specifically, because I don't know what the staffs have looked like or what other, you know, circumstances are surrounding the situations for each of the different quarterbacks. But I don't think you can deny the fact that, generally speaking and statistically speaking, quarterbacks regress in their second year under Brian Kelly. I don't know what the reason is. Like, you know, my gut says, well, there's a lot of pressure. And I mean, you heard it a lot from most recently Deshaun Kizer, when prior to the season, he was talking about just like owning the team and making it his and all these expectations he had. And then I think, you know, if teams don't live up to expectations and it falls down to a quarterback who feels like it's his responsibility, that plays on your psyche a little bit. And I don't know if that's what happened to Kizer specifically or any of the other quarterbacks, but I mean, that's kind of how I would see it as an outsider. And I don't know if there's something formulaic that can be changed on Brian Kelly's end or on the staff's end that can fix that mentality. I'd love to see that with Ian Book. I know Brian Kelly's already said he expects Ian Book to be better this year. And right away, that's, you're putting pressure on your quarterback. And I mean, you should expect a second year quarterback to be better, but also Brian Kelly's done a really good job of looking inward and making changes on his program that have produced better results. I wonder if this is another area where he could do that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it cuts both ways. If you, there's certainly an argument on the statistics side that is strong. I think if you want to be a Brian Kelly apologist, and I'm accused myself of that a lot, you can kind of explain away some things, you know, Golson, 2012, but then he missed 2013. So he came back in 2014. So there was that year gap, and maybe that had something to do with it. And, you know, as the Irish Illustrated guys like to remind us, Deshaun Kizer put on a lot of weird, bad weight before the 2016 season. So, you know, and obviously that team was going off the rails defensively, which, as you mentioned, put a lot of pressure on the quarterback. So maybe that was, you know, for his regression. Brandon Wimbush, I mean, it's hard to say, right? And so the one thing that I would say is that the numbers of Ian Book were much different post-Northwestern injury than they were pre-Northwestern injury. And I think that's a confluence of two things. One is the not being used to playing with an injury, especially a rib injury, and sort of understanding how that process works and adjusting for that. Two, that obviously the competition got a lot better after that. Clemson certainly didn't help matters at all. But I think a team's got tape on him. You know, I think that he benefited the same way Deshaun Kizer benefited in 2015, was a lot of people didn't really know what they're getting into. There wasn't a lot of plays that Ian Book had really, really run. So there was, and he was more of a guy that you stuck in when the outcome was never in doubt or for a specific package of plays. So you didn't really understand what he could do. And so obviously didn't play till the fourth game, significant time until the fourth game of the season last year. So once teams got more tape on them, they kind of understood tendencies a little bit better. And maybe I think that would had something to do with the kind of the regression, but I'm hoping that this is a level reset. And that, you know, there's talk about the offense averaging 40 points a year. I don't believe that they've done that. They, maybe not in the modern era. Maybe they've done it in the past, like in the way, way past, but that's kind of been the unattainable mark. But that's the talk this year. I mean, they certainly have a lot of weapons, don't they?
They do, yeah.
Yeah. So to be determined on that one, I suppose. Next is I want to talk a little bit about the map that you created, and I want you to talk about it a little bit because I think it's really interesting. One of Josh's things that he likes to think about is where all the Irish come from. We've talked a lot about, you know, where the Irish have recruited in past years, but it's also as interesting to see the makeups of the team. So you've tracked every person who committed to a Brian Kelly team at Notre Dame, and you put them on a map. And I just was wondering if in doing that, you had any surprises or takeaways that you wanted to share with us.
Well, first off, I think the map is really cool. I'm a little biased, but I really enjoy just, you know, the creativity that it takes as the end user of the map that I've created to like kind of click around. You can go in and see what you want to find out on your own, or you can go in and look for something specific, and there's enough little filters in the dashboard that you can usually get to what you're trying to get to. And I think that's really cool. I haven't spent enough time doing that. I've spent all the time on the back end actually creating the thing. So, you know, my takeaway is like that took a long time, and it was some hard work, but it just for me, like clicking through the different years and remembering the kids that aren't there anymore, seeing where they came from, seeing where different, how the focus shifted when the staff changed. So if you click on like pre Van Gorder and look at the defensive recruits, you might be surprised to see some people or surprised not to see some people, not surprised to not see some certain positions being recruited versus post. And you see the recruiting pickup on the defense. And then you can go and look at those years and see, you know, 2 to 3 years down the line, they really had something on defense once Elko and Lee took over. That's like one really cool thing that you can do. On the other hand, you know, it's also beneficial to zoom out of the map and look around because we've even got the kid from Germany on there now. So if you zoom out, and it's really kind of jarring to see a recruit that came from Germany and a couple from Hawaii, and remember that it's not just limited to North America. I think that's another cool thing to do.
Yeah, it was very cool. And I think that, you know, a lot has been discussed about the fact that there was a extreme Florida interest in the first, would say probably 6 or 7 years, and now that's really the focus has shifted more towards Georgia and a little bit on Louisiana, which I think is interesting. And you look at that Florida team, and it's a who's who of if they had just lived up to their hype, that Notre Dame had some amazing guys. You know, Kevin Stefferson comes immediately to mind, but also Greg Bryant. You know,
yeah.
Guys that really kind of had derailed careers here. So, yeah, I encourage everyone to go to onefootdown.com and check out that map. We've updated it for 2019 to include all of the most recent commits, as Brad alluded to, with our Germany commit. And we will continue to periodically update that so that you can continue to play around with it. And if you find something interesting, leave it in the comments, either of this post for the podcast or the post on the page, and let us know what you found interesting, because we're always looking for interesting patterns.
Yeah, and if anybody's really bored, you should go out and look at like the overall trend of players coming from Florida at that time, where they were going and how they panned out. I would do it. Actually, I might do it.
Awesome. Well, yeah. I look forward to that, and if I can be helpful, then we'll do it.
Yeah, we'll do it.
Last Saturday was graduation at Notre Dame. I think 2,055 individuals got their Notre Dame degree last Saturday. Unfortunately, they had to do it inside because of the weather. One of those individuals was Jalen Smith. Obviously, everyone who has watched Notre Dame football in the last 5 years remembers Jalen Smith. He is now a linebacker for the Cowboys. I believe he was the team's second leading tackler last year. Just doing this from memory, so if I'm wrong, Claire Wall will probably tell me in the comments. But anyways, he's had a fantastic pro career post-injury so far in the limited time we've gotten to see him. And he had made a promise to his coaches and to, I believe, his mother that he would come back and get his degree. And he did that remarkably by taking 21 credit hours in the last semester to finish that off, which I think Brad, I went there for 4 years. I'm not even sure I ever took 21 credit hours. That's quite a course load. So
yeah, I've taken exactly 15. So
perfect. I believe he is now the fifth out of 17 people that have left for the NFL early and have not finished their college to actually come back and actually close that off. So I know that Stephon Tuitt and Troy Nicholas are currently working on it, as is Josh Adams. I believe Adams may be the closest, although Nicholas was on campus because he's injured and he doesn't have an NFL team right now. So the one thing that helped Jalen Smith was he had gotten a lot of his major credits out of the way, the credits towards his major. And those are the ones that you have to take on campus. There's a residency requirement, I guess. And that's not what Troy had done. So that's why Troy had to come back and actually hang out in Indiana. But a couple of cool takeaways. Obviously, love the fact that guys are coming back for their degree. I also love the fact that Brian Kelly and the entire football staff is saying the Goog is yours to use for workouts. Please, find a time that works for you. They had, the scholarships were already paid for. So whatever the NFLPA didn't pick up, Notre Dame picked up the rest. So you might say, well, the guy's got millions of dollars. Why can't he pay for his own schooling? Like, I just think this is good. I think it's good karma. It's good PR. I love the whole thing. Brad, any other thoughts?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's remarkable to me, not just for specifically with Jalen, but with all of these other guys, like the drive that it takes to come back and do this. I mean, Jalen had to come back from the injury, and he's playing better than a lot of people thought he would. And I think he still hasn't reached his professional ceiling yet. I still think he could be a star, but he also has the drive to maintain that whole NFL lifestyle in terms of working out and staying at your best, not NFL lifestyle in terms of partying, but come back and, like you said, take 21 credit hours in a semester. That's ridiculous. That the amount of drive that takes, like, I can't even imagine being motivated enough to do that, let alone also being an NFL player. That's just ridiculous to me.
Yeah, I mean, I started looking through the list of guys who left without getting their degree, and I guess Jerome Bettis is sort of at the top of that list. And it's like, you know what? I really don't think it makes any sense for Jerome Bettis to come back and get his degree at this point. I think he's pretty well set in his life, and he's made oodles of millions of dollars, and obviously he's in his retirement. He's doing well for himself. But I still think it's interesting that Jerome Bettis has said, it embarrasses me a little bit that I wasn't, that I didn't get my degree, and that I'm not that example for my children when I try to impress upon them the importance of getting a college degree. So I love the idea that Jalen Smith knows that his NFL career could be taken away from him at a moment's notice, and that he's setting himself up nicely with a plan B. And to Deshaun Kizer and Julian Love and Josh Adams and all the guys who've come out recently, I really hope that they recommit themselves to doing it. For Golden Tate, I think he'll be just fine. I think he can live without another Dame degree. So,
and Kyle Rudolph, who just is going to get a huge deal. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, yeah, great point, Brad. I mean, they're talking about a 5-year contract extension for Kyle Rudolph with the Vikings. So if he gets that, then he probably is not sweating, missing out on that Notre Dame degree. So that's great. I wanted to talk to you about something that I think irked a lot of people. We didn't write about it for One Foot Down, but it was a 24/7 sports article that came out about a week ago, ranking the top coaches in all of college. And I just want to go down the list and I, you know, feel free to stop me where you think it gets weird. But I think the first couple you're not going to really have much issue with. Number one, obviously, is Nick Saban of Alabama. Number two is Dabo Swinney of Clemson. Number three is Lincoln Riley of Oklahoma, which, you know, he's only had 2 years, but, you know, two playoff appearances. So, right. So that you really can't take that away from him. Number four is Florida State's Jimbo Fisher, but Texas A&M's Jimbo Fisher. Five is Chris Peterson of Washington. Six is Mike Leach of Washington State. Seven is Pat Fitzgerald of Northwestern. This is where it gets weird for me.
This is the do more with less category.
I mean, the one takeaway of this writer, and I believe it was Brad Crawford from 24/7 Sports, was he likes guys that do a lot with not a lot of talent. You know, Northwestern is not the school that a lot of Big Ten, you know, people who are looking at the Big Ten aspire to be at, right?
But that makes them the best.
Yeah. So if he's able to produce a, you know, 9-3 or I guess it would be 9-4 or 8-5 or the occasional 10-3 season with Northwestern, then he's overachieving in terms of what Brad Crawford thinks Northwestern should be able to achieve with the talent that he's been given. Right. So number eight is Gary Patterson of TCU. Number nine is Matt Campbell of Iowa State. Now I got killed in the comments section. I wrote an article, I believe in January, that said basically Brian Kelly wasn't retiring and he wasn't leaving for another job, but let's go through the mental exercise. What would it look like? You know, who would be on the short list? And I didn't like Matt Campbell. I looked at his record, the fact that he's never beaten Iowa, the fact that he lost to an FCS team. He is 5-5 against top 25 teams, which Iowa State has never beaten five top 25 teams in 2 years. So that's a major accomplishment. And I think the main argument for Matt Campbell is, look, he's taken a Big 12 team that was a complete afterthought in the Big 12, and he's turned them into just above 500 team. You know what I mean? In two seasons or whatever. So,
right. And is that where the hype is coming from? Because Matt Campbell's name came up for the Browns opening too. And I was like, why are the Browns talking about Iowa State's coach before they hired Freddie Kitchens? Like, and same thing for what you're talking about. If Brian Kelly leaves, I don't see it. I don't get it. What do these people know that I don't?
You know, I think it's just you fall in love with a flavor and then all of a sudden you just can't get yourself off of that. I mean, I was thinking about the names that were tossed out when I'd done the exercise the year prior, or when Kelly went through the 4-8 season in 2016. And some of those names were some people were honest to God saying Bobby Petrino. Some of them were honest to God saying Gene Chizik. You know what I mean? Like, just names that, like, given a couple more. Mark D'Antonio, and he's on this list at number 14. And, you know, Mark D'Antonio, yes, he had the playoff appearance, but he also had a 3-9 season on his resume recently. And he sort of is like Brian Kelly's yang to Brian Kelly's ying. They're kind of, he's on the downslide. Like, he peaked in 2015 and now he's like, and he had like three great seasons. I think 2013, 2014, and 2015 were just, I think it was 36-5 maybe for Michigan State in those three seasons. So they were outstanding. And now it's just been, you know, wet fart after wet fart in terms of the seasons they've been putting together here. So I don't love Matt Campbell. I'm totally willing to eat crow if he has a 10-3 season with Iowa State next year and beats Iowa and maybe pulls off a upset at Texas or somebody. I don't even know if Texas is on their schedule, but I'm just assuming with the Big 12 and all. So I'm ready to and willing to see what other people are seeing, but right now I just don't get it. I just don't get it. So and I think number nine is way too high on this list. So continuing on, and you notice I've not mentioned Brian Kelly yet. Number 10 is Kirby Smart of Georgia. Number 11 is James Franklin of Penn State. Another guy who's just like, what the hell has he accomplished? You know, number 12, Dan Mullen of Florida. Number 13, Tom Herman of Texas. Number 14, D'Antonio, as I mentioned before. number 15, David Shaw of Stanford, and then number 16, Brian Kelly of Notre Dame. Now,
really,
look, I have just look, I'm, you know, I may not be the biggest Brian Kelly homer on the internet, but I'm probably in the top 10 percentile. You know, I don't blame anybody who wanted him gone after 4-8. I wasn't in that group. It doesn't make me a better person than the people who wanted him gone. Maybe it's blind stupidity or belief or naiveness, but I've liked Brian Kelly. I think he is a top 10 coach for sure in this list. And I would definitely put him ahead of Pat Fitzgerald and Matt Campbell and James Franklin and Tom Herman because I love Mike Leach. Mike Leach is great, but I just weren't, you know, Brian Kelly has a playoff appearance now. Brian Kelly also has 4-8, but Brian Kelly has had a national championship appearance and a college football playoff appearance and a lot of other really good seasons sprinkled in there, you know?
I specifically don't see Tom Herman ahead of Brian Kelly. I mean, in terms of just overall career, Brian Kelly did great things at Cincinnati, just like Herman did at Houston. And Brian Kelly's done more at Notre Dame than Herman has at Texas.
The Sporting News, I think it was today, the Sporting News came out with their prediction for the college football championship, Texas versus Clemson. And I'm like, are they trying to sell magazines?
Yes, that's exactly what they're doing.
I don't see that, you know? And I don't look, I was also the guy that poo-pooed Kyler Murray and Trevor Lawrence last year and said that they were, you know, how could Athlon possibly consider Trevor Lawrence to be the 25th best quarterback and Kyler Murray to be the 16th or whatever he was? So, look, I make a lot of bad, dumb takes, but, you know, Clemson, I get Clemson. Texas, look, they got a lot of talent returning, but they do not have it all together there. So beating Georgia in the Sugar Bowl when Georgia couldn't care less doesn't impress me. So
I enjoyed it, but I wasn't impressed.
One of the things that we should definitely do is take a nice little break here for our sponsors. And we're going to do that right now. Okay, awesome. Thank you. So before we close out tonight, I want to talk a little bit about Game of Thrones. I don't actually watch Game of Thrones. Are you a Game of Thrones guy?
I have some very strong opinions about Game of Thrones.
Correct. Awesome. So my timeline on Twitter was covered for probably the greater half of this first week here, this current week that we're in, talking about Game of Thrones ending and also the worst television endings of any program ever. So let's talk about I'll give you the floor to talk Game of Thrones, and then let's talk about worst television endings.
All right. Well, here's my thing about Game of Thrones. And most people I know are sick of hearing about this because everybody's been talking about it lately. I have to remind them, look, I tried the first episode 5-6 times. I just couldn't get through it. And it's not that like I dislike the IP or I dislike the period like take on it, or I dislike just the whole world or what's happening. And I think the story had a lot of potential, but you know, what I prefer in my entertainment, my literature is a little like subtlety and like a little nuance. And I don't like the way that Game of Thrones hit me over the head over and over and over again. Like, did you know that winter is coming to Winterfell? And by the way, it's cold. It's called Winterfell. It's so cold. It's Winterfell. And it is so cold that we name our bastard Snow because winter is coming. Did you know that it's going to be cold? And by the way, our Reavers, they're called White Walkers, the color of snow. And that enough for me was just like, I get it. Like, I just stop hitting me over the head. I get it. Like, I understand what life is like here now. Yes, you're very afraid of this very long winter. Thank you. And then they just kept doing it. They did it with every aspect of the show. And every time I tried it, it's just like, I can handle gore and I can handle, you know, these ridiculous amounts of characters all oddly just intertwined and they can't keep all the little white kids straight and they're all related to each other. But having sex, I can handle all that. But just, man, the writing was just too heavy handed.
Did you get past the first episode?
No, I think I managed to watch a little bit of the second episode on one play, but I did no, I don't remember what it was. I remember meeting like the Dothraki and what's her name, the blonde chick, and that's yeah.
Zero help here. I watched one episode because I fell into, everyone was talking about it. There was like, it was a reverential tone, the way that people talked about how great the episode was. There were entire podcasts delivered towards, you know, breaking down each episode. And I sort of got into that with Breaking Bad, where I was kind of listening to the, like, the meta commentary from the, you know, the show's producers and stuff like that. So I thought, well, you know what? This Game of Thrones has, you know, a real promise here. I watched the first episode. I don't get it. And they still haven't said anything about dragons. And I know dragons are coming. And I'm not a dragon guy. Like, I'm not a dragon dude. So, like, I know that some people were like, the dragons, you know. And look, I'm not here to bash on anybody's take, because I watched a lot of terrible television. We could talk about that for ages. But, yeah, it just wasn't for me. And, you know, frankly, I was feeling a little good about my choice based on the last, I would say, 4 or 5 weeks of people just complaining about how the episodes have just underwhelmed them, disappointed, not tied up loose ends and stuff like that. So this brings us into the greater discussion of worst TV endings. What show did you stick with long after you probably should have and were disappointed by the time the ending came around?
I mean, this is a lot of people's answer, I think, prior to either Game of Thrones or Dexter, but it would have to be How I Met Your Mother. I watched way too much of that for how it ended. It was just insulting.
I mean, if you followed me on Twitter, I was literally like hate tweeting about How I Met Your Mother. I felt like I'd spent, and again, they were what, 22 minute episodes, but yeah. Again, you start adding it all up and you think to yourself, I invested 9 freaking years in this program, and they felt like they were jerking me around.
Yeah. You know? I mean, yeah, for me, I wasted a summer binge watching it because I was a season behind. I could have been out having fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was funny to me that when people were posing this question on Twitter, that Lost and How I Met Your Mother were easily the top two responses. You know, I saw sprinkling of somebody would say MASH or something like that. There was a couple of other shows that people were kind of like, yeah, and Dexter was certainly mentioned. I got to be honest, I skipped out on Dexter about a season and a half till the end because I was just already like, this just doesn't feel like the show I fell in love with. That first season of Dexter was just such outstanding television. I could not wait for the second season. I was all the way bought in on that.
Yep.
And then I think, did it go 6 seasons, like 5 or 6 seasons? And somewhere, I think it was in the mid fourth, I was just like, you know what? I'm out. It's just really not doing anything for me anymore. And my wife stuck it out. And so I said to her, hey, you know, like, what happened? She's like, it just was not worth it. And I was like, okay,
we're here. I struggle to stick with shows when they fall off like that. I'm thinking of like, these are shows that are still running, but like I watched a single episode of the second season of True Detective, and that had all kinds of goodwill built up from the first season. And after one episode, I was like, I can't deal with it. And then when there's like IP that I love, again, I'm like you, I'm not going to claim to be a fan of and an expert on what makes good television. And I will gladly admit that the CW's superhero shows are not good television, but that's like some of my favorite IP and I love it. But I dropped out of like after the third season of Arrow and the second season of Flash because it was just complete garbage. So I don't have that tolerance.
I salute you. I am what the economists refer to as sunk costs. I believe that, you know, if I've given 4 seasons to a program that, you know, I should see it to the end. I really, you know, with the exception of a couple of shows where I was just like, you know what, you're gonna have to finish this one without me. I really have stuck with a lot of shows way past the time I've probably gotten enjoyment out of them. I recently told my wife that I had no interest in watching another episode of Arrested Development because I couldn't remember the last time I had laughed at Arrested Development. And that's a show that the first, you know, what was it? First 3 season run on Fox. It was just so great.
That's like the only show that I've ever been not able to stop watching. Like just put the next episode on up until the end of the third season.
Yeah. And then they went to Netflix and then they waited 5 years in between episodes and they recut episodes and it never recaptured that original spark. And I know it's it feels like low hanging fruit to dump on a show that everybody's dumping on. But it just, it just got to the point where I felt like my time was being wasted. I was literally just watching characters act out to something that I don't think even they thought was funny. So I was kind of over it. So let's flip the coin here. Best TV endings, shows that you felt like you were satisfied with by the time it was all said and done.
Oh, man, I got to think of any shows I've even watched all the way through that aren't still running.
I mean, did you watch Breaking Bad? Because I really felt like that was very, very satisfying. Another one I thought of was The Wire. I think a lot of people mentioned that. You know, so many people in my timeline have mentioned Justified as a show that I should have watched. It's hard. You know, it's hard to revisit shows. You don't want to be – I watched Breaking Bad probably 3 seasons after it went off the air. And so when I was like ready to talk about Breaking Bad, everyone was like, dude, where were you in 2013 when we were all doing this? You know what I mean? So, yeah. it's sort of like telling a friend, you should watch Deadwood. Like, Deadwood was a great show, but like, you know, I think we're all past the point where we've talked about Deadwood unless the Deadwood movie comes out. And then
that's what I was gonna say. I'm not watching Deadwood unless I know that movie's coming out.
Yeah, exactly. So if the movie's happening, then sure. But, you know, and so it's hard for me to start watching a show that has ended because you sort of wonder where your tribe's going to be. You know what I mean? If you're just like, if you announce on Twitter, wow, I just watched this most amazing episode of, you know, show X, everyone will be like, yeah, that was great when it happened in 2011, buddy. You know, like, or worse would be like people just straight up ignoring you, just being like,
yeah.
Okay, well, congratulations for sinking, you know, 26 hours of your life into the show or whatever.
Yeah, maybe you should go listen to
24. Another show that I completely abandoned that had a great,
which,
like, 24. First season.
Oh, 24, yeah.
So much fun, and it was like, oh my God, look at how it's crazy, 24 hours in his life. And then it was like, and then a bomb, and then a hostage, and then a, you know, and then a nuclear football. And I was like, oh God, I'm over it, you know?
All right, 24 hours was enough.
My wife,
the next 48.
Grey's Anatomy, they're 15 seasons deep on Grey's Anatomy.
I've never watched a moment of that show.
I tapped out on Grey's Anatomy, the episode in which Izzy decides a deer is more important to save than the people who are coming into the hospital with real injuries. I was like, you know what? I'm good here. I think that was the beginning of the third season. So I am 12 seasons removed from my last episode of Grey's Anatomy, and I think I'm okay on that. So.
I believe they call that jumping the shark.
Yeah. You know what I've been doing at night? I've been watching current season Simpsons.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know why. It's not really like there's been a couple of yucks, but I don't know who their audience is anymore. I don't even know if I'm their audience.
Right? Yeah.
I
haven't kept up with the Simpsons. I've been actually catching up on King of the Hill. I didn't realize I liked King of the Hill until like 3 or 4 weeks ago. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but that show is deeply relatable to somebody who grew up in a small farm town in Ohio. Oddly enough, it's based in Texas, but culturally, the satire is on point.
Yeah, no, I am aware of it. I don't believe I've ever watched an episode. So
I was there about a month ago, and then I started it, and I'm in season 9 now.
You have no one to talk to. You know, it's funny because every once in a while I see a show that was on that was either running now or was on forever, and I go, who watched that show? Like, George Lopez show was on for 8 years. I don't know a single person who watched George Lopez show. I was snarky and one night said, who watches Superstore, which is, I think, is in its 5th year on NBC. I've literally seen commercials for it, but I've never heard anyone talk about it. And about 4 or 5 people jumped in my mentions, was like, yeah, no, I watched it. It's pretty funny. And it was like, oh,
okay.
All right. So there are people watching it or whatever. Bob's Burgers is another show that one of my friends is like a total Bob's Burgers guy. And they're probably, I feel like, 6 or 7 seasons deep on that. And I don't know anybody else who really watches it.
No, actually, you know what's really funny and actually kind of weird about this is, like, literally 2 nights ago I was watching King of the Hill and my TV was too loud. So it was like, you know, like 8:30 or 9, and I got a text from my upstairs neighbor, and I look and I see that it's him, and I'm expecting, like, dude, turn your TV down. But I look down and he says, what episode or what season of King of the Hill are you on? It's like, at the end of the eighth, he's like, oh, that's awesome. I just discovered it. I'm halfway through the ninth. It's still very good. And I'm like, wow. So sometimes there are people out there that you can talk to.
Is he the kind of guy you could have down for a beer and like watch King of the Hill together with?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. He still owes me a beer because he remodeled his entire unit when he moved in and it was really loud. And he's like, all right, I'll buy you a six pack to make up for it.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, that was our discussion for tonight. Brad, do you have anything that you want to add that we didn't talk about that you think people should know about?
Well, I thought it was interesting. One of the first names that came up when the Michigan basketball coaching position was open was Mike Braz.
God, yes.
And literally the least like that, I not even for better or for worse worried at all about that happening. I still maintain that the only place Mike Braz will coach that is not Notre Dame is Duke when Coach K retires. I also thought it interesting that Mike Braz commented on the transfer portal saying that a lot of coaches are worried about the amount of waivers that are being granted to players to be eligible immediately, which goes back to our boy Elohi Gilman and what happened there. So just some interesting things to think about here for the next week.
Yeah, just real quick, did Mike Braz possibly being interested or Michigan possibly being interested in Mike Braz, did that go beyond the Dan Dakich kind of tweet, or was that just like him speculating out loud?
It was him just saying one name to look out for, and everybody just sort of waved him away. Literally, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you hate to think of coaches like, you know, they're ours and you can't ever be this and stuff like that. I don't know if Mike Braz a cultural fit for Michigan. I just know Mike Braz a great cultural fit for Notre Dame. And, yep. Even just watching him earlier this week talking about the newly designed Rolfs, the new space for them or whatever, it just reminds me how much that he's been kind of fun to have around for a long time now. I mean, he was the coach my final year of college, and I've been in college for a billion years. So. All right. So my final plug is final plug I've had probably for the last 3 weeks. Go see the Hesburgh film. I rewatched it on Sunday. I took three people with me. Of course, they loved it. If you haven't gone to see Hesburgh, check out hesburghfilm.com for showtimes in your area. I believe they just added 20 new cities. There are six or seven that are coming online next weekend and the weekend after that. So if it's not playing in your area, go to Hesburgh Film and ask for it to come to your area. Look, the audiences are small, but the people that are watching it are loving it and they're getting a lot out of it. And I'm here to give you my guarantee. If you go, you're going to love it. If you don't go, tweet at me. I'll throw you 10 bucks in the mail. I'd be absolutely shocked. So take a chance, spend the money, and go see Hesburgh. All right, that's going to do it for tonight. Brad, thank you very much for your time. And everyone else, have a great night and go Irish.
Go Irish. Thank you.